Welcome to the West Virginia Humanities Council Little Lecture Series. Today's program features Peter J. Hatch, Director of Grounds and Gardens at Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia. On March 18, 2012, he spoke on Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden at Monticello. Little lectures are presented each spring at our headquarters, the historic McFarland Hubbard House in Charleston.
Good afternoon and welcome to the historic McFarland Hubbard House. I'm Ken Sullivan, and on behalf of the West Virginia Humanities Council, I want to welcome you to this year's little lecture series and to this fine old house. We've been doing some landscaping here. I think most of you know that. And especially under those circumstances, we are thrilled to have one of America's top gardeners with us today. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. As Director of Gardens and Grounds for the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, Peter J. Hatch has been responsible for the maintenance, interpretation, and restoration of the 2,400-acre landscape at Monticello since 1977. He has an English degree from the University of North Carolina and an AA in Landscape Gardening from Sand Hills Community College, also in North Carolina. All of you English majors should take heart. This is the reason that we study the humanities. Mr. Hatch has managed important restoration projects at Monticello, such as the 8-acre vegetable and fruit garden and the grove, which is an ornamental forest of 18 acres. In 1987, he initiated the Thomas Jefferson Center for Historic Plants, a unique nursery to preserve historic and Jefferson-related garden plants. He also oversees numerous educational programs, including the garden tours, the Saturdays in the Garden program of natural history, walks, lectures, and horticultural workshops, and the Historic Landscape Institute, which is a 2-week field school for students from across the country. In 1993, Mr. Hatch initiated and managed for 12 years the Evening Conversations series, which honors the legacy of Thomas Jefferson with after-hours symposia on a variety of topics. He was also project manager for the Thomas Jefferson Parkway, a $7 million project to create a park along the entrance corridor to Monticello, and for Saunders Bridge, a stone arch bridge that now serves as the new entrance to Monticello. A native of Michigan, Mr. Hatch previously served as horticulturalist at Old Salem in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He is the author of The Gardens of Monticello and the editor of Thomas Jefferson's Flower Garden at Monticello. He has written numerous articles and has lectured in 35 states on Jefferson and the history of garden plants. His scholarly study of early American pomology, Thomas Jefferson's, the fruits and fruit trees of Monticello, Thomas Jefferson and the Origins of American Horticulture, was published by the University Press of Virginia in 1999. His new book, A Rich Spot of Earth, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden at Monticello, will soon be published by Yale University Press. We have order forms for that, by the way, at a couple places in the house to receive signed copies of that book when it's published. Mr. Hatch has served as president of the Southern Garden History Society from 1998 to 2000. In 2004, he received the Thomas Rowland Medal from the Massachusetts Horticultural Society. He has served as an advisor and source of plants for Michelle Obama's White House Garden, which has a section honoring the garden legacy of Thomas Jefferson. In 2012, Mr. Hatch was the first professional horticulturalist to be awarded the prestigious Medal in Historic Preservation from the Garden Club of America. He is married to Lucille Brandt Hatch, and they have two daughters, Rosemary, 21, and Olivia, 18. So please join me in giving a big West Virginia welcome to Peter J. Hatch.
Well, that was a very nice introduction. I appreciate it. I have two children in college, so I do the best I can with what I have. But it's a real honor and a pleasure to be here in Charleston this afternoon. And I wanted to talk about this book that's just hit the bookshelves, at least in Charlottesville, Thomas Jefferson's Revolutionary Garden. And it's really the story of the Monticello Vegetable Garden. So I'm going to focus on one specific topic this afternoon because it's one that's truly fresh in my mind. And I think that Thomas Jefferson's overseer was a man named Edmund Bacon, and he said that the flower gardens of Monticello bloom virtually all year round in every month of the year. Visitors to Monticello were commonly given tours by Thomas Jefferson of what one visitor called Mr. Jefferson's pet trees. Jefferson grew 170 varieties of the fanciest fruit known at the time in his orchards at Monticello, which he grew fruit for what he called their precious refreshment, alcoholic beverages like apple brandy and apple cider and peach brandy. Jefferson's legacy as a grape grower and a winemaker is constantly recalled by a growing Virginia wine industry today. Jefferson said amazing things like, "No nation is drunken when wine is cheap, and wine is indispensable to my health." And his legacy as a grape grower, and not so much as a winemaker, is constantly recalled in our part of the world. We hear almost too much about it. But it was really Thomas Jefferson's vegetable garden that was really the chief horticultural achievement of his tenure at Monticello. This was really the garden, this 1,000-foot-long terrace, was really the garden of Jefferson's retirement. Between the ages of 67 and 83, between 1809 and 1826, bent with age and a little arthritic, Jefferson would go out into this garden and sow peas, or write down in his garden diary when his salsify was harvested in November of 1814. Gardening for Jefferson was sort of a barometer of health, a rage against the torpidity of age, going into this garden and actually sowing the seeds himself. Even at the age of, gosh, this is a little stubborn for me, I'm sorry. Even at the age of 83 years old, Jefferson read about 6-foot-long cucumbers in a Cleveland, Ohio newspaper. And in true Jeffersonian fashion, he wrote to the governor of Ohio and asked for seeds of these giant cucumbers and got them and passed them around to his friends at Monticello and grew them in his garden and measured each one to see how long it was. Self-described old man but a young gardener, Jefferson was really playing that role when he was planting his cucumbers in 1825. This is Isaac Jefferson, who was freed after Jefferson died and became a blacksmith in Petersburg, Virginia. And Isaac recalled years after Jefferson's death that Jefferson himself would work in the garden at a right hard pace in the cool of the evening. And Jefferson himself pretty much regarded himself as the head gardener, particularly during his retirement years. A friend of his named Margaret Bayard Smith recalled how there was this wooden frame that was carried from planting site to planting site. And on the frame, this portable frame, were hundreds of glass vials and tin canisters of seed. And from that, Jefferson would take the seed and actually sow the garden himself. Although Jefferson's pretty much regarded as the most cerebral of American presidents, he was very handy. He would actually, in the garden himself, he was a great surveyor. And he would go out in the middle of wintertime on some 5 different occasions to lay out the beds in his garden. He kept changing things, building up and tearing down this garden. And here, for example, in 1810, one can see Jefferson out in February. It was probably a muddy day. Again, he was probably a little stooped with age. He had his theodolite, which is like a transit. And with the transit, he had a chain that would measure distance. And he would measure out each of these beds. He was probably assisted by the man who's sometimes called Monticello's head gardener, an enslaved African-American named Wormley Hughes. And one can imagine Jefferson surveying out these edges of the garden and telling Wormley, "We'll put a stake down there." And then he moved the transit around and staked the other side of his bed. Isaac, who I showed an image of earlier, recalled that Jefferson was as neat a hand as ever I did see.
Yeah, that's gorgeous.
To make keys and locks and small chains, iron and brass in the blacksmith shop at Monticello. So it's interesting to see actually Jefferson in the garden doing at least some of the work himself. Certainly the lion's share of the labor was done by African-American slaves at Monticello. But the flower gardens, for example, were taken care of by Jefferson's daughters and granddaughters. And the orchards were often taken care of by a series of itinerant European gardeners. So it's difficult to generalize about the character of labor at Monticello, but certainly Jefferson was an active and vibrant participant in the gardening process. One of the first things you learn about Jefferson is that he was such a keen and avid record keeper. And he kept a garden diary called the Garden Book. And the Garden Book today is at the Massachusetts Historical Society. It's 67 pages. And you can go home today and Google Jefferson's Garden Book and read it online. And the Garden Book really reflects Jefferson as a garden scientist, writing down how many pea seeds would fill a quart jar, which would in turn plant so many garden squares in his garden himself. And you see Jefferson as a scientist, as an experimenter. And you can see this is from Jefferson's garden calendar in 1807. And you can see the reiteration of here's all the varieties of vegetables he was planting, and here he is writing down what happened to them. You see the repetition of the word failed some 23 different times. You could perhaps say that few gardeners failed as often as Thomas Jefferson, or at least confessed to failure as often as he did. He said that in gardening, it's the failure of one thing that is repaired by the success of another. And Jefferson had almost a holistic view of the gardening process. When the Hessian fly was eating his wheat crop, he seemed much more concerned about learning the life cycle of this destructive insect rather than the fact that his wheat crop was about to go down the drain. So anyway, the Garden Book also is a reflection of Jefferson as a child of the Enlightenment. Let's go back to this picture right here. I'm kind of losing mine. Here's Jefferson, another page from Jefferson's Garden Book, where he organized the whole garden into three categories. Fruits, roots, and leaves, according to which part of the plant was being harvested. This is a period when Carl Linnaeus, the great Swedish natural historian, organized the whole vegetable and animal world into two categories, the genus and the species. And this was a revolutionary sort of achievement. And here's Thomas Jefferson organizing all the vegetable world into the part that is harvested, where the fruits, roots, or leaves. Here he is, Jefferson, very cataloging and organizing and defining the natural world that was going on around him. But this garden was also, I think, fun for Jefferson. And the Garden Book really documents one man's dance with the elements in so many different ways. In the vegetable garden, he planted different colors of the scarlet runner bean, purple, white, and red, and so forth. This is the Caracalla bean, which Jefferson said was the most delicious flowering bean in the world, a real favorite of his in the vegetable garden of Monticello. He planted purple and white eggplants and adjacent rows in his garden, and purple, white, and green sprouting broccolis. He played around with cross-fertilization by planting squashes and cucumbers and melons right next to each other in the garden to create new variations. He reveled in odd-colored vegetables and many-headed cabbages and other curiosities of the vegetable world. So Jefferson was very much a participant in the garden process, and he was having a lot of fun. This is very much, in many ways, an American garden. Its scale and scope is really continental in so many different ways. This 1,000-foot-long terrace was literally hewed out of the side of the mountain. Jefferson hired 7 slaves from a Fredericksburg, Virginia farmer, and over a period of 3 years, they moved the dirt, some 400,000 cubic feet of earth, with a mule and a cart. The terrace itself was supported. It was undertaken not only by these enslaved people that Jefferson hired, but under the leadership of Edmund Bacon, who was the overseer at the time. The garden itself was supported by a 1,000-foot-long stone wall that some places is 15 feet high. And below the wall was a 400-tree orchard that sort of formed a horseshoe around Jefferson's 2 vineyards, and also berry squares where Jefferson grew currants, gooseberries, raspberries, and figs. So it was really a large, sprawling complex of some 8 acres at Monticello. This also was a revolutionary garden, I think, because because it was an experimental garden. One wonders if any man had grown so many different things in one place before Jefferson documented some 330 varieties of some 89 different species of vegetables in this garden. He wrote that the greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant to its culture. And this garden really became an Ellis Island, if you will, of new and unusual plants from around the world. And Jefferson, in turn, was very much the seedy missionary of the vegetable world. He'd get unusual things, unusual seeds, and pass them around to his friends and family, neighbors, but also some of the leading plantsmen of the early 1800s. So Jefferson lived this idea about the greatest service which can be rendered any country is to add a useful plant. And this range of things that he grew was really enormous, from the Texas bird pepper that he got from an American Army captain stationed in San Antonio, Texas, to the sesame plant. Jefferson was a vegetarian. He said he ate meat only as a condiment to his meals. And he was forever seeking a good vegetable oil for the preparation of his kitchen vegetables. And while he was president, he had a blind tasting of salad oils, and the participants liked the sesame oil even better than the olive oil. So that set off this mad passion by Jefferson to grow sesame year in and year out in his kitchen garden in order to extract an oil from the seeds that come from the plant later on in the summertime. But a typical Jefferson fascination with sesame. To cabbage seeds that he sent back when he was serving as minister to France, like the Chaux de Milan Savoy cabbage, really a beautiful thing with variegated foliage. In the upper right-hand corner are some rutabagas. It's hard to prove that Jefferson actually introduced himself any new plant into American gardens, but the rutabaga would have been a good candidate. Jefferson was sending out seeds in 1795, just a couple of years after the rutabaga had been introduced from Europe into England. And so we think of Thomas Jefferson as the author of the Declaration of Independence and third president of the United States. You also might think of him as Thomas Jefferson, rutabaga man. I think the garden was also American in terms of its continental panorama. This garden itself overlooked the Virginia countryside, looking to the southeast toward Richmond, Virginia, across the rolling Virginia Piedmont for some 60 miles. Or if you look in another direction toward the southwest, you see the dramatic uplift of a mountain called Mont Alto, which means high mountain in Italian, as opposed to Little Mountain, which is what Monticello means. At least two people who visited Monticello referred to the garden pavilion. Jefferson sometimes called it a temple. They referred to it as an observatory. So it's easy to think of this garden as this consciously designed perch for Jefferson to look down upon what he called the workhouse of nature. He said, "How sublime to look down upon the workhouse of nature, clouds, thunder, lightning, all fabricated at our feet." So the dramatic setting of this garden is also, I think, very, very American. It was also a revolutionary garden in the sense that one wonders if any man had grown so many different kinds of vegetables in one place before Jefferson assembled this collection at Monticello. And most gardens in Virginia around 1800 didn't have much going on in the middle of the summertime. They were relying on cool season European vegetables like root crops, like turnips and salad greens like lettuce and spinach, and root crops like turnips and cabbage family members like cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower. Things we take for granted today really are not at all common in Virginia gardens. Many of them came from hot weather. So many gardens in Virginia were bare of vegetables in the summertime. Things like tomatoes and hot peppers and eggplants. There's a pretty eggplant, I'll show it to you. And okra, which I mentioned earlier. These are vegetables, peanuts and lima beans, sweet potatoes, crowder and black-eyed peas. Things that go really well in our hot summer gardens are really kind of unknown in Virginia around 1800. And Jefferson's garden was really admirably designed. The microclimate was really perfect for facing to the southeast and capturing a wealth of crop-ripening sunshine. So it was a revolutionary garden in the sense that Jefferson was growing all these new and unusual vegetables that were well-adapted to the microclimate that Jefferson created at Monticello. And Jefferson was was also following a tradition of vegetable kitchen garden. In his library were dozens of books telling people how to grow gardens. They're mostly European books. And the English kitchen garden in particular was this really bustling village in which gardeners would use a lot of artificial techniques to bring vegetables and fruits to the table out of season. They'd use brick walls to hasten the fruiting of fruits that don't like cloudy weather, like peaches and pears. They'd use greenhouses and cloches, and the central ingredient was what's called a hotbed. And a hotbed was basically a cold frame that was filled with unfermented manure. And on top of the raw manure was garden soil. And this was in sort of a frame that could be closed up, kind of like a little mini greenhouse, and enabled gardeners, as the fermenting took place and the greenhouse was warmed up, to bring asparagus to the table in December or to grow melons throughout the winter month. And this was a practice known in Virginia around 1800. Some of Jefferson's friends, some of the leading lights in early Virginia horticulture, and Jefferson had seen these gardens in Europe when he was serving as minister to France, these really sophisticated European kitchen gardens. And at places like Mount Vernon and, I'm sorry I'm jumping around so much, I'm just having a little trouble with a button. Places like Mount Vernon, the gardeners used hotbeds, and if you look at their jobs that they were doing at places like Mount Vernon, you can see they're doing a lot of fussy things. They were pulling the grass out of walkways, and they were mowing grass, and they were raking the gravel, and they were edging beds. And what makes Jefferson's garden also, I think, very American and very revolutionary was it was very pragmatic. It was not a fussy garden at all for Jefferson. He was not concerned about aesthetics. He was just interested in sowing seeds and harvesting and bringing things to the table. It was very American in its practicality in so many different ways. And also the real genius of the garden is this microclimate I talked about earlier, facing to the southeast, that enabled vegetables to be grown almost all winter through the winter months, things like cabbages and lettuce and spinaches and cauliflower and endive. And also one of the few advantages of gardening on a mountainside is the fact that in the spring and the fall, the cold air tends to settle in low places while warm air rises up over the elevation of elevation like Monticello. And Jefferson would avoid frost that would kill his neighbor's fruit trees, and he would often gloat over this fact. But one of the few advantages of gardening on a mountaintop is this air inversion that makes it a little bit warmer, in fact, in the evening and the morning, in the spring and the fall. It's a kind of interesting microclimate. In some ways, this garden was one big hotbed because of the advantage of it and its south-facing exposure and the way it was carved out of the hillside. This revolutionary garden also, I think, very much inspired a revolutionary cuisine in the kitchen at Monticello. And we know about what was prepared in the kitchens through the documents in the University of Virginia Library that have recipes that were written out by Jefferson's granddaughters, and also his daughter, and also Jefferson himself. And there's a wonderful recipe for okra soup, in effect gumbo, in the hand of Jefferson's daughter Martha. And this has a real wealth of vegetables in the gumbo recipe. There's patty pan squashes, and there's lima beans that were grown by North American Indians when the first Europeans arrived in North America. There was tomatoes that were native to Central America that were found by the Spanish and introduced into Europe and became really popular very early on in the Mediterranean region, in Italy and Spain and France. There was potatoes in this recipe for gumbo, and that's an Andean vegetable that was also found by the Spanish, and when introduced into Europe in the 16th century, it became very popular in the northern countries, in Germany, Great Britain, and the Scandinavian countries. And this is all brought together by an African plant, okra. And okra was brought to the New World in slave ships, and it was creolized by the French in the Caribbean. Then okra plants were brought into southern seaports like Charleston and New Orleans. And then this whole dish was brought together in the Monticello kitchen by enslaved African-American chefs who'd been trained in French cuisine, both in the President's House in Washington, but also when Jefferson was living in Paris. So what a great blend of all these different gardening as well as culinary kitchens, culinary traditions that are brought into the kitchen at Monticello. One person described the cuisine at Monticello and at the President's House in Washington as being half French and half in the Virginian style. And Monticello might have been more of the Virginian part of the equation, while the White House or the President's House might have represented more of the French part of the equation. Jefferson kept a master plan of the menu in the President's House. It was written in French. It was probably copied from his French chef, a man named Honoré Julien. And one of the recipes is for French fries, what we call French fries today. And there's a good argument that can be made that Jefferson was the first person to introduce French fries into American cuisine by way of his French chef in the White House. Jefferson also kept this chart. It's really an amazing compilation by him over the 8 years he was president of the United States of 37 different vegetables and their first and last appearance in the farmer's market in Washington, D.C. And according to one of Jefferson's friends, a woman named Margaret Bayard Smith, Jefferson would go around to foreign embassies and they would vie with each other to give Jefferson the most unusual kind of vegetable. Jefferson would get the seeds of these things, and then he'd pass them out to local farmers with instructions on how to grow them. And then he ordered his French household administrator, a man named Etienne Lemaire, to pay the highest prices for the best-looking tomatoes or the earliest cauliflower that came into the market. As well, this French household administrator named Lemaire kept a log of all the purchases for President's House meals in 1806. And you can count them up, and they bought lettuce 106 times, and parsley 93 times for White House dinners, a real window into early American cuisine. But we look for models in our interest today in local food and local farmers and sustainable agriculture. And here's Jefferson really 200 years ago kind of really laying a nice foundation for an interest in those things today. At the same time, Jefferson's garden wasn't the only garden at Monticello. Enslaved African Americans had their own gardens out on the plantation. They'd work these gardens on Sundays and after their work in the fields was over. And we have from the Jefferson family these account books of purchases that were done on Sundays of eggs and chickens and cabbages and cucumbers and carrots and beets that were made from the enslaved workers at Monticello. It's pretty interesting. When Jefferson's granddaughter, her name is Ann Carey Randolph, between the ages of 14 and 17, her sort of rite of passage was to purchase these vegetables from African American workers at Monticello, and she kept a log of it. And at this crossroads of black and white worlds at Monticello, one wonders, you know, who was driving the hard bargain, this 14-year-old girl or some of these really wizened, experienced slaves at Monticello, like Wormley Hughes. A lot of the purchases were of things that were out of season, which is really interesting, that the slaves had household pits in their basement where they could preserve a lot of vegetables. And it was really common vegetables, and there were large quantities of purchases of things like cabbage and cucumbers, everyday vegetables. And one wonders, well, why did Jefferson need to buy vegetables from the slaves when he had such a big garden? But most of the purchases took place when the Monticello garden was relatively dormant. When Jefferson was away as president, or he was in Paris, or when he was a very young man before gardening really got started at Monticello. This is the site of one of the enslaved gardens at Monticello, and Monticello is in the distance. It's just a little mountain, and this is a plot where Jefferson, on a map, drew a site for what we call Abram's Garden. It's pretty interesting that there was this alternative economy taking place by slaves from their gardens that were out in the 25,000-acre plantation at Monticello. In slave gardens, this was common at most big plantations in Virginia and throughout the South, that slaves were able to negotiate the sale of produce to the big house. I think another feature of the garden that's real important is just the nature of Jefferson's passion for the gardening process. He wrote to the early American portrait painter, a man named Charles Wilson Peale, and he said, "I've often thought that if heaven had given me my choice of position and calling, it should have been on a rich spot of earth, well-watered, near a good market for the productions of the garden. No occupation is so delightful to me as the culture of the earth, and no culture comparable to that of the garden. Such a variety of subjects, someone always coming to perfection, the failure of one thing repaired by the success of another. And instead of one harvest, to continue one throughout the year. Under a total want of demand except for our family table, I'm still devoted to the garden, but though an old man, I'm but a young gardener. It's a lovely, elegantly composed fantasy about Jefferson's desire to be a market gardener. One of my favorite garden writers was a man named Henry Mitchell. And Mr. Mitchell said, yeah, Jefferson wanted to be a market gardener in the same way that Marie Antoinette wanted to be a milkmaid. But Jefferson's quote is well known because the way it really resonates with all gardeners from all ages, really. The statement about the failure of one thing being repaired by the success of another is a wonderful statement, not only about gardening, but about, in many ways, the human condition. When Jefferson talked about the repeated harvest through the season, he was expressing this sort of elemental hopefulness and essential humility that is very much part of the gardening process. Jefferson's favorite vegetable, generally considered to be the pea, the English pea. He reserved some 5 squares in his garden and grew 23 different varieties. When Jefferson had a second home near Lynchburg, Virginia, he'd often go visit there in the springtime, and his neighbors at Poplar Forest, as it was called, would often begin their gardens very early in the springtime so that when Jefferson arrived, they could give him fresh peas. It became associated with Jefferson like Ronald Reagan gets associated with jelly beans. He also had famous contests with his neighbors to see who could bring the first English pea to table, the winner hosting a dinner for the losers that included a feast on the winning dish of peas. And the family story goes that Jefferson rarely won the contest. There was a fellow nearby named George Divers, who pretty much regarded himself as the king of the pea contest. He lived at what is now Farmington Country Club, and he was really an excellent gardener. And the story goes that the one year Jefferson brought the first pea to table, he refused to divulge the victory to Mr. Divers in fear of rocking the pride of his good friend. And Jefferson's granddaughter recalled how Jefferson was the least competitive gardener of any gardener she'd ever known, and was always happy to see the success of his friends over his own victories at Monticello. This is Mr. Divers' house, and Jefferson designed the left-hand side of it with an octagon room with columns out front. Divers was perhaps Jefferson's best friend outside the world of politics, and he was really a great gardener. And his efforts served as sort of a safety net for Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. And Jefferson would get unusual seeds from around the world, and he'd always share them with his neighbors as well as some of the leading plantsmen of the early 1800s. And he'd always give things to Divers, and then when Jefferson would kill these things at Monticello, he could always go back to Divers to get replacement plants. A real lesson for all gardeners about sharing what you have, because it sometimes can come back and be valuable for you. So Divers was a major figure, and you know Divers would write to Jefferson, "Well, remember the black-eyed peas you brought back from Paris that I hear you've lost? You know, here's some to replace your stock." So he played a very important role. We also know a lot about cooking from a cookbook that was published in Richmond, Virginia in 1824 by a woman named Mary Randolph. And the cookbook was called The Virginia Housewife. Randolph was Jefferson's second cousin. She ran a boarding house. And her cookbook, The Virginia Housewife, was really a revolutionary cookbook in the way that it began to define a distinctive form of Virginia and Southern style cooking. And a lot of the recipes for unusual vegetables in Mary Randolph's cookbook duplicate the recipes in the Jefferson family manuscripts, suggesting that there was an interaction of ideas and recipes between the two families. Jefferson owned a copy, and his personal recipe for mashed potatoes is in it. So it's very much a new kind of book. She has over 17 recipes for the preparation of tomatoes, suggesting adaptation of this little-known vegetable at an early date. And Jefferson's lettuce was a big, important crop at Monticello. One year he sowed lettuce 25 times in one season. He harvested lettuce every month of the year at Monticello. And he had to have it, and he had to have it all the time. It was integral to his salads, his fresh salads at Monticello. And 1824, Jefferson published a gardening guide of his that he wrote in an American periodical called The American Farmer. And it's a general gardening calendar, and a calendar meant that you give the months of the year, and under the month you tell what you do for each of the various kinds of vegetables, when you plant them and when you harvest them. And here is an interesting reference to, he said, a thimbleful of lettuce should be sowed every Monday morning from February 1st to September 1st. And that's kind of interesting. You think about that. The first thing you do when you get up on your work week morning, on Monday mornings, you go out and you sow your thimbleful of lettuce, as if that's a life lesson akin to brushing your teeth every day or cleaning your dinner plate. And sowing that thimbleful of lettuce every Monday morning will lead to long life and moral virtue or whatever. And Jefferson later learned that lettuce gets pretty bitter in the middle of the summertime, so he changed this a little bit over time. But if you look at the records of when he was planting things, over 50% of the lettuce sowings took place on Mondays, which is pretty interesting in some ways, a regimented man. This was a favorite variety of his called Brown Dutch that he planted for harvesting throughout the winter months. And the tennis ball was one that he reserved for growing at Poplar Forest, his second home. He said it didn't require as much attention as other sorts, so it was good for a place where his visits were more sporadic. Lettuce was commonly boiled when it got bitter in the middle of the summertime and eaten like you would spinach. But salads were important to Jefferson. Cabbage was a garden workhorse for Jefferson. He grew some 37 varieties of cabbage. It was integral to the garden around 1800 because it was such a versatile vegetable and could be almost harvested every month of the year. Mary Randolph in her cookbook said that cabbage should be as beautiful dressed, that is, cooked, as when growing out in the garden. And one of the intriguing references in Jefferson's account books is purchasing 79 cabbages from one of his slaves, Gil Gillette, on December 24th, Christmas Eve of 1823. 79 cabbages, and one wonders, you know, what was they doing buying 79 cabbages on Christmas Eve? Were they just making a Virginia version of sauerkraut? Were they buying these cabbages as gifts for the community? Did they regard them as ornamentals that they might be passing out to and decorating the house with cabbage? Kind of intriguing. Jefferson had his own personal recipe for stuffed cabbage, which basically involved cutting out the hearts and stuffing them with meat, the hearts of the cabbage. And cabbage was a big deal in early Virginia gardens. I'm having so much trouble changing my pictures.
Do you want us to tap it?
Well, I think I might have to come up with a stamp. Because you don't know when to do it.
Do you want us to just hit the advance?
No, I'll do it. I'm not in your way, though. I'm just about done. So this is another one of Jefferson's favorite vegetables called sea kale. And sea kale is a perennial cabbage that grows wild in Great Britain. And when it grows wild, the emerging shoots, when they come up out of the ground, are covered with shifting beach sand. And what that does is it prevents the sun from hitting the leaves and prevents the creation of chlorophyll. It really reduces the bitterness in the leaf itself. So that in the garden, what replaced the shifting sands blanching the leaves were sea kale pots. And when the plants emerge in the springtime, they're covered with pots. And when the plants get to be 8 or 10 inches high, they're still kind of white looking because the sun hasn't hit them. They're cut off, and in Jefferson's words, they're prepared like asparagus. And Jefferson ordered pots from a Richmond potter. This is another case where Jefferson's initial planting of the seeds of sea kale failed, but he got replacement plants from friends, and all of a sudden in his garden diary, you see his charts of when vegetables were being harvested, and sea kale occurs repeatedly. So an interesting vegetable. Jefferson said almost everything was prepared like asparagus when giving directions on how to cook things. So I'm not sure exactly the best way yet to prepare sea kale. But it's a beautiful plant with those bluish-green glaucous leaves in the summertime. But a perennial cabbage is really kind of interesting. The tomato, Jefferson spelled tomato, T-O-M-A-T-A-S, tomatas. And they were a kind of often scorned vegetable in Northern Europe and Virginia. In some ways, they're often too sexy and too sensuous for their own good. When first introduced into medieval Europe, people were just shocked by the sprawling, viney habit and the kind of stinky leaves and the kind of the shirt-wetting juiciness of the fruit itself. So there became a lot of mythical and diabolical associations of the tomato with other members of the nightshade family. In addition, Northern Europeans, I think there was sort of a little bit of bias because they associated this plant with the Mediterranean. And they said, well, this is something they eat down in the south, but not we wouldn't touch them around here. But at least in Jefferson's lifetime, they gradually became accepted. Now, this is an early American painting of a traditional-looking tomato. Jefferson's son-in-law was really a pretty astute horticulturist, and he gave a speech before the local agricultural society in 1824 about plant introductions and how plant introductions were improving people's lives. And he said that in 10 years earlier, in 1812, no one was eating tomatoes. But by 1822, he said, everyone in Albemarle County, which is where Charlottesville and Monticello is, were eating tomatoes because they believed they quickened the blood in the summertime, whatever that means. A lot of recipes for tomatoes in the Jefferson family recipes. This is a favorite of mine called Purple Calabash, sort of that patty pan shape and the heavily lobed and kind of weird-looking manifestations of the shape of the fruit itself. But tomatoes weren't smoothed out until later in the Victorian period. Turnips were, in some ways, to the garden world of the 18th and 19th century to what tomatoes are today, in that they were integral, really important. Like cabbages, they could be used all year round. A favorite recipe for the Jefferson grandchildren was turnips with cheese, very much kind of Virginia comfort food. And this is the garden of a man named Landon Carter, who lived at a place called Savin Hall around the time of the American Revolution. And Carter was the richest man in Virginia, and he had the most ornate flower garden. And this is the design of that flower garden. It was a parterre flower garden. And Carter one day got, in the middle of summertime, his garden was sort of burned out by the heat and drought of summertime. He also wasn't feeling very good. So he was very depressed, and so he decided, well, I'm going to tear up my flower garden and just plant turnips. He was very satisfied with this sort of thing and said, well, at least we can use the turnips. These flowers are pretty worthless. A couple other references to Jefferson's contemporaries, two of them who dug up their front yards around their house and planted turnip fields around their house. And today, you know, we have permaculturists and people who are urging Americans to dig up their lawns and plant vegetables. And here's the real precedence for it taking place early in the 1800s. Salsify was a favorite root vegetable of Jefferson's, and it's called oyster plant. One of his granddaughters has three different recipes for preparing them, including boiling them and then mashing them into cakes and covering them with breadcrumbs and frying them in butter. It really is a really good vegetable. Cucumbers were a favorite of Jefferson's. He bought huge quantities from his enslaved workforce in Monticello. There's a family story that Jefferson was killed by a cucumber. It's a joke, but 3 days before he died, he harvested a cucumber out of his garden, and he was never well afterwards. And so when he died, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of stories about in early Virginia, before even Thomas Jefferson, about people growing giant cucumbers. And one guy in Williamsburg, a man named John Custis, was growing giant cucumbers, and it became an interest in the local Williamsburg newspaper, and they wrote a story about these 5-foot-long cucumbers and how people would come from miles away to see them. And this guy in Boston read about these stories and said, yeah. So he wrote and said, well, you know, for your 5-foot-long cucumbers, I had 200-pound watermelons up here. We grow things much better up here. So he decided to sort of mock civil war between gardeners in Boston and gardeners in Williamsburg about who could grow the biggest vegetable. And boys will always be boys, I guess. And here's a cucumber from the 16th century, and you can see it looks kind of knobby and not the torpedo smooth-skinned fruit we associate with the plant today. The garden restoration took place at Monticello in the late 1970s, and this is a view of Monticello from 1975, showing parking lots going up very much to the front of the house itself. And we began the restoration of this garden with years of archaeological excavations. Every time you disturb our heavy red clay soil, you leave some sort of lasting imprint in terms of the color, the texture of the soil itself. And here, archaeologists covered tree hole stains with newspaper where they found stains in the ground. In the left center of your screen, you can see these little dots where they found stains. They put newspaper over them, and it formed a grid pattern that was identical to a map that Jefferson had drawn in 1778. And at the same time, along the left-hand part of your screen, you can see this closer spacing, and those were actually stains of fence posts that the archaeologists found. And that enabled us to put back the fence that Jefferson had surrounding this entire complex. It was 10 feet high and ran for nearly 3/4 of a mile around this entire fruit and vegetable garden complex. And archaeologists also uncovered the foundation for the garden pavilion and parts of the garden wall that supported the terrace. And so that was also part of the restoration that began in early 1980, completed this garden pavilion in 1984 and the garden wall a couple of years before that. So it was a very, some people call it the most accurate garden restoration effort that has ever taken place in the United States because of this use of archaeology. And the garden has inspired a lot of art. The legacy is still alive. This is a tapestry done by a woman named Carol McGuire. It's 20 feet long, and it shows an aerial view of the garden. It's done in wool or in some kind of cloth. Isn't that cool? And here's the tapestry of the garden live. Here's some other views of her. The famous American photographer Annie Leibovitz visited last year, and she took photographs of the garden for a book that's just been published by her called Pilgrimages. So the garden is still alive in a lot of ways. And Michelle Obama recently said that the White House kitchen garden was perhaps the most important thing she'd ever done in her life so far. And we've been an active consultant to that garden, and their chefs have come down many times and became inspired by Thomas Jefferson and the garden at Monticello, and they have a discrete section in the garden honoring the legacy of Thomas Jefferson, where I go every springtime and plant Jefferson varieties of lettuce and spinach and cabbage, and here's the little discrete section honoring Jefferson with the failure of one thing repaired by the success of another quote. But Jefferson's legacy in vegetarian cuisine and organic gardening and local food is really quite profound. He was the first foodie in so many different ways. First in wine, first in gardening, first in food. And we celebrate those things that are so interesting to people today in a festival at the end of the middle of September every year called the Heritage Harvest Festival. So I think that's conclusion, except to push my book. It just appeared on bookstores on Friday. It's published by Yale University Press. It's got 200 photographs. It's 300 pages long. And you can order a copy if you wish, or you can come to Monticello and visit us, or you can go online and read all about the gardens of Monticello and buy seeds from that we raised in the gardens of Jefferson Broad. So do you have any questions?
Did you bring seeds?
No, I didn't bring any. I just brought my towel. I should have, but I was too disorganized. Any other questions? Yes.
Are you having anything to do with Poplar Forest, the restoration?
Yeah, I'm on their advisory committee, and so we have great debates about a lot of issues. And so I have an influence, not much of one. But I... we have a, Poplar Forest is a, a fascinating place. It's a gem of a building, and the landscape is not much, so they haven't done too much to it, and it's pretty blank, and the archaeologists kind of rule the place. They've been digging for years and years and years, and it's a great discipline, but the more they find, the more questions they have. And Jefferson had some interesting schemes for it. There's a geometry to the house that in some ways he tried to duplicate in the geometry of the ornamental landscape. So Poplar Forest is y'all should visit it because it's a beautifully restored building, and it's, in many ways, it's a perfect little building, and Jefferson described it that as being preferable to Monticello and being much more within the means of a private citizen. Yes?
What do you use for pest control?
What do we use for pest control? Deer like, is our worst problem.
They like mine too.
We have dogs. We have a dog patrol that we put out at night to,
really?
In theory, chase away the deer. And we have invisible fence, and they have collars. And It's been tragic, comic 15 years of the dogs, putting them out. You know, one got run over by a night watchman, one blew out his leg, one ran away. One can see a video of the dogs going after the deer, one end of the garden, and then seeing the deer sneak in. We harvest the deer at Mount Shasta, but it's still a huge, huge problem. We put out deterrents. Pest control, you know, I have a whole chapter here on pests in the early 19th century, so we try to look at it holistically, the Jefferson experience versus our own. We have a lot more pests than he did. So we aspire to be an organic garden. Sometimes because the garden is an economic garden and it's a seed garden, we'll resort to using chemical controls of things. But we have a high tolerance for pest damage, and we like to interpret it in our garden tours about the history of pests, and was that pest around Jefferson's day, or was that weed around? And how did weeds and diseases and bugs evolve in American gardens? It's sort of an interesting story. So Jefferson wrote a beautiful letter to his granddaughter when she complained about the insects ravaging her cabbage plants as fast as she could set them out in the kitchen garden. And he said the problem with the plants, because she said they were eating everything she was planting, was not the bugs. He said the problem was the fact the soil was bad. He said that winter the two of them would cover the entire garden with a heavy coating of manure. He said when plants are growing in rich soil, they will turn, in Jefferson's words, bid defiance to all sorts of droughts and pests and diseases and bugs and so forth. So he was kind of carrying the banner of the organic gardening movement. He didn't have too many alternatives at the time, but it reflects a sort of balanced belief in the way that the nature and the garden can work together really successfully.
Are you doing composting, so to speak?
Yeah, we compost our stuff. Leaves that we mow in the fall, and refuse from the gardens, and we use any kind of, we cover the entire garden every year with some sort of organic matter. It might be rotted manure, it might be compost, it might be rotted leaves. Might be rotten wood chips, whatever we can find, we like to put back into the soil.
Is there an herb garden?
I didn't hear any of your talk, but so I apologize.
Bad boy.
If you get you next time. But you may have spoken to this, I'm not sure. But what in your opinion, is, would you say it was Jefferson's biggest gardening disappointment?
The one that's recalled most is Jefferson's a failed grape grower. Failed winemaker, because he never he documents making lots of beer and lots of cider in Monticello, and he planted his vineyard 7 times, but he never documents making wine. So that's the thing that people talk about the most, is that how he failed as a winemaker. And I don't think that really disappointed him the most, because I don't think he was really aspiring to be a winemaker. I think he was just playing around, experimenting with a wide range of both table and wine grapes. So, but that's a story that's often recalled by people as in terms of his failures. But he also wrote one time that if he failed 99 times out of 100, that one success was worth those 99 failures. And really, at the core of his sort of experimental garden was this willingness to have everything die on him.
Was there an herb garden?
Yeah, I was asked if there was an herb garden, and that's another good question. This idea we have of these colonial herb gardens is really sort of something that was made up in the 20th century by garden clubs and historic restorations and landscape architects to conform sort of this idealized view of the harmonious past, the colonial revival. And in fact, when herbs were grown, they were generally grown in kind of out-of-the-way microcosms around a house. One guy who was a friend of Jefferson said, well, he planted his wormwood and thyme in the bed next to the meat house. And another guy planted his catnip out in the alley. But then he also had rows of rosemary and lavender and sage in his garden that he trimmed as sort of a hedge. So herbs were commonly used as edging. But the idea of this, pretty little herb garden is sort of
a
little bit of a romantic idealization of the past. There were exceptions. There were medical gardens among doctors, and that was a mixture of the Mediterranean plants we call herbs, as well as some native wild plants.
Lavender for the linens.
Yeah, lavender. Has a variety of uses. It was in the vinegar of the four thieves, which was a mixture they put in the sick rooms to kind of banish the evil vibes going on, but also to make things smell nice. One more question. Yes, sir.
What happens to the fruits and vegetables that you grow today?
Well, I mentioned we have a big seed program where we grow a lot of things and let them go to seed. We put seed preservation plot, a sign that says that next to the row of crops. And we sell a lot of things to the Monticello Cafe, which sells food and sells meals to people who come to Monticello. And then periodically we'll harvest stuff and pass around to people who work at Monticello. So we have a lot of different functions for the garden today. And it has a lot of different uses. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Hatch.